Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. I get spring fever in the kitchen. After being perfectly happy with soups and stews for months, I want light. So we'll start with roasting fish and flipping crepes, two ways to achieve seasonal culinary bliss. And of course, we'll need to choose the right wines. So let's dig in. Susie Chang is a New England-based freelance writer and the Boston Globe's cookbook reviewer. She has written about roasting fish for Kitchen Window Online and joins me today from her home in Leverett, Massachusetts. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Susie, I followed your recipe last night for roasting fish, searing it first in a pan. I used salmon. Can you tell me why it was so delicious?
I think it has to do with the searing it first and then putting it in the oven, because salmon is an oily fish and it self-bastes in the oven, and it gives it a really good golden brown crust when you sear it in the pan. And then when you put it in the oven, it kind of gently cooks it so it just comes to that perfect point where it's moist but not rare in the middle, not too rare in the middle, and it's even throughout, which is really hard to do with salmon if you're just frying it in a pan.
It really was extraordinarily good. We were just sort of ready to lick the plate.
Great.
You say that it's harder to overcook fish roasting it. Why is that?
I don't have a technical explanation, but I believe it's because the air in the oven just cooks the fish more gently. When you put a fish fillet onto a hot pan, the surface of the pan gets up to 700 or 800 degrees. So you'll get a really well-cooked out exterior, but sometimes it can be practically rare on the inside. And you can even burn the exterior of the fish. But if you put it in the oven, somehow the hot air circulating around the fish seems to cook the exterior and the interior evenly at a steady but thorough pace. And you can really go a minute over, a minute under, and you will still have a really delicious tasting fish. It's just a much more forgiving technique.
In your piece for Kitchen Window Online, you talk about three ways to roast fish. Can you go over those?
Okay, well, the first way is what we've been talking about, the pan roasting, where you sear it in the pan and then finish it in the oven. And that's a wonderful way to do it if you are using a thick fillet of fish, especially if it's an oily fish like salmon or Arctic char. And then the second way is to roast the whole fish over a bed of vegetables, also totally effortless. You just season the fish. You can season it with salt and pepper. You can go as minimalist as that, or you can put other spices on if you like, and then just put a few vegetables underneath to give it some aroma and have a little something to serve it with. And slide it in the oven, and 20 minutes later, depending on how thick the fish is, it's done, and it's delicious, and it has that wonderful vegetable flavor from the bed that you roasted it on. And then the third one is really, really fun, which is roasting the whole fish packed in salt. And it feels a little bit strange to do it at first because you're using so much salt. You're using like a third of a box of kosher salt, and you mix it with egg whites. And you really get in there with your hands and play with it like you're at the beach and you're playing with the sand. and you pack that sand-like salt all around the fish. And when you put it in the oven, this miracle occurs. The salt just dries out and forms this incredible hard crust. And when you take it out, you just smack it with a spoon and it cracks. It falls into pieces before your eyes. It's really, really fun. And something about roasting it in salt imparts this sweetness to the fish. I don't know why. Maybe it's because the salt doesn't seep out of the fish, but it just gives it this tenderness and this sweetness that you can't get any other way.
And it's not salty.
And it's not salty, no. All you taste is this sweetness, almost a nutty quality to it.
And it seals the moisture into the
fish,
too.
It seals the moisture in, exactly.
I have cooked a whole fish in salt, but I had not roasted fish these other ways. Mm-hmm. Why do we hear about roasting fish so rarely?
You know, I have not been able to figure that out. I think it's becoming a bit more of a trend lately. I think that the traditional ways to cook fish were baking and poaching and sauteing. But I think people just shied away from the idea of using really high heat in an oven on the fish. I don't know why that is when it works so beautifully.
Well, it does seem like it's awfully delicate to blast with heat.
It does seem like that. And you would think that you would in some way either dry out the fish or it would be the texture of the fish would be impaired. But it doesn't turn out that way. It's really astonishingly delicate.
How did you get interested in doing fish this way?
Well, I was one of those people who is always really intimidated by fish. And I think it's just because fish is so perishable, you have to use it quickly, and you have to do it on the spot. I always felt like there was really no room for mistakes. And so I really avoided making fish. But as I mentioned in the article, I had this wonderful monkfish when I was young, and I cooked it very rarely because it was so expensive, but it was a pan-roasted monkfish, and I never forgot the way that tasted. And in recent years, I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if I could do that with other kinds of fish? And so I only really started experimenting with it this year, and I realized just how easy it was and just how delicious.
Well, a lot of readers agree with you because we've had a lot of email. People tried it and love it and have thanked you.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Well, Susie, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Bonnie.
That was freelance food writer Susie Chang. Alejandra Garcia was born in Lima, Peru, and raised in both Kentucky and North Carolina. She now lives in Marbella, Spain, where she is an editor for a Spanish lifestyle magazine. Wherever she lives, she makes crepes. She has written for Kitchen Window Online about what she calls her obsession. Hi, Alejandra.
Hi, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Thanks.
Is calling crepes an obsession an overstatement?
At this point, it's not an overstatement. It's something that I pretty much incorporate into any sort of dinner party, or it's the first idea that comes to mind when I'm trying to put a menu together for friends or something like that.
Some people would think that making crepes is tricky, but you make it sound very simple.
Well, it is simple, since the batter is put together by just a few simple ingredients that most people have in their kitchen. You can make the batter, and then you can pretty much, when it comes to the fillings, it's just what you can come up with. It's all imagination, and it's all about your tastes and likes.
What is in the batter?
The batter is made up of flour, water, milk, eggs, and butter. And then if you would like to add a pinch of salt or sugar, depending on if you want to make a sweet or a salty crepe, that also varies.
Crepes are so versatile. They can be sweet or savory. They can be dessert or dinner.
That's exactly right.
You talk about using buckwheat flour. Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, buckwheat flour, that's also something a little bit tricky, but it's also something for those that are looking to have a little bit of a healthier crepe. It is a fruit seed. It's not a cereal grain like most people would think when they hear the word buckwheat flour. But it's a great alternative to wheat or all-purpose flour. It's high in fiber and in vitamin B, and the fluffy taste of it is just wonderful, and it's also visually very different, very appealing.
Does it taste different?
Some people say it doesn't have much of a taste, but I think it's great. There's no real way to describe it because most crepes take on the taste of their fillings, but I certainly like it.
How did you get so interested in crepes?
Well, this goes back to a trip I took to Paris. I was studying abroad in Seville for a semester during my sophomore year in college. And we had a vacation from studying abroad, which is great. We had vacations from studying abroad.
Vacation from vacation.
A vacation from vacation, that's right. And we decided to take what little money we had and book a plane ticket to Paris, France. And I was going along with three other friends, and we were going to stay for 5 days. And as I got off the subway stop in Clichy, I noticed this tiny crepe stand, but it had a line of people going around. But the thing I noticed the most was the smell, and it just smelled so great. I didn't know what it was. And I walked up next to it, and I just saw this man with this huge, flat, cast iron pan. And he had this wooden, almost toothless-like rake that he was, you know, pushing all of this batter around. And people were walking off with crepes wrapped up in aluminum foil. And I thought, I have to go there.
And you did.
And I did. And that became a constant for the 5 days that we were there.
And they made all sorts of crepes?
Yes, they made all sorts of crepes. The basic ones that I saw people run off with were the Nutella hazelnut spread with bananas, or dark chocolate melted with whipped cream. But they also had crepe Suzette, which is the first time I'd ever heard of it. And this was made with Grand Marnier and melted butter and sugar.
Did they flame them at the stand?
They did flame them.
Wow.
They flamed them, yeah, with this little torch. And it was so tempting.
And then you went home and practiced for years.
Exactly. And then I went home and I thought, this is something that I could do.
And you say you can put anything into a crepe.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite toppings was dulce de leche, which is something that goes back from my Peruvian heritage. It's something that we put in many desserts and that I saw my mom put in pancakes and in cakes and cookies.
And what is dulce de leche?
Dulce de leche is condensed milk that is boiled for an hour or two, and it turns from, you know, a light whitish, yellowish color to a dark brown color. And it's very rich in sugar, so it's very, very sweet, and it goes great with crepes. I normally put the dulce de leche with bananas or strawberries. It's a great way to put a crepe together.
I want to ask you a question about the pan you cook the crepes in.
Yes.
There is a crepe pan. Is that necessary?
No, it's not necessary, especially whenever I first started making crepes. I obviously didn't even know it existed. I saw the one this man was using, which was, you know, like I said, a cast iron, really flat pan, which made it a lot simpler for him to spread the batter evenly and then to flip it in the end. But I just had, you know, a normal 10-inch, 12-inch nonstick pan, and that worked fine for me as well. And later on, I found in specialty gourmet shops, you know, that they did carry flat cast iron pans or steel pans nonstick, and those work as well.
In your piece for Kitchen Window, you talk about leaving the batter for a few hours. Why is that desirable?
Well, normally whenever you finish making the batter, you're going to notice that there's a few bubbles that are on the surface. And whenever you put it in the refrigerator for a few hours, it allows the bubbles to subside. And that, in turn, whenever you are pouring your batter onto your hot pan when you're ready to make them, it makes it so that the batter is less likely to tear. That's just a trick that I actually learned from this French man in Paris that was making the crepe.
Alejandra, you make the batter. How long can you leave it in the refrigerator?
You shouldn't leave it overnight, but you should leave it between 1 and 3 hours in the refrigerator.
What happens if you leave it too long?
Well, it just becomes a little bit thicker, actually, and you want the batter to stay thin.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
And enjoy Spain.
Thanks.
That was writer and editor Alejandra Garcia.
Madam, I love your crepe Suzette. I think your crepe Suzette is wonderful. But for the moment, let's forget all about your crepe Suzette.
It's great to have these nice light dishes for spring, but we face the same problem we always do when planning a nice meal. What wine to serve? So I've asked Michael Green, the wine consultant to Gourmet Magazine, for help. He joins me from his office in New York. Hi, Michael.
Hello there.
Thanks so much for your assistance here.
My pleasure. Talking about pairing wine and food, it's something that makes me salivate.
Michael, let's start with crepes. I sent you the piece we ran on Kitchen Window online about sweet and savory crepes, and I'm wondering what you would recommend for those recipes.
Well, here's how I would approach it. I take a bit of a contrarian approach when it comes to pairing wine and food, believing that if you pair a wine that's in balance and you like with a food that's in balance and you like, most probably you're going to have a wonderful marriage. When it comes to pairing wines with crepes, I think about a crepe as a white canvas, a substrate that, depending on what you fill it with and how sweet the crepe is, as relates to your wine selections, there's a lot of flexibility. So is there any specific type of crepe preparation? Or maybe you can give me several, and we can walk through what types of wines could possibly be great pairings.
Okay. Well, we have two sweet crepes, which would be dessert crepes. One is simply filled with berries, and the other has a hazelnut spread, a Nutella spread, and fruit filling over that.
Well, I'm a big fan of what I call a bridge wine or a bridge beverage, meaning that you can drink something that might be an ingredient in what you're making. So noticing that the crepe Suzette filled with Grand Marnier and butter and sugar, you could perhaps do a sparkling wine from Spain, and rather than adding peach nectar, you could add a few tablespoons of Grand Marnier, and I think it would be a lovely, lovely pairing. With respect to the nuttiness of Nutella, if you want to pair a wine based on similarity, there are certain wines out there that their flavor profile is quite nutty. And in that category, I would say some of the sweeter styles of sherry, like an Oloroso or a PX. But I think just the idea of dessert wine is so wonderful because it's so overlooked by many people, and it can be a great way to cap off a dessert.
That sounds lovely. The other crepe she talks about is a savory crepe filled with chicken, mushrooms, and red peppers in a pesto sauce.
That sounds very lovely, and I think because there's no ingredients that are really sticking out that would shout, danger, danger. There's nothing overly salty or overly spicy, but I think it gives you a fair amount of flexibility. But I would take my inspiration as one idea from the pesto sauce, and that might take me to a place in Italy. And pesto could work very, very well with a fresh, light, and lively, crackling with acidity, Italian white, maybe something from Friuli or Corrientale, like a great Sauvignon Blanc or Pinot Grigio. Another wine that could work would be a wine, again, from Italy, that's marked by really great acidity, which I think would work well with the salt that's in this dish and cut through a lot of the flavors and leave your mouth fresh and ready for the next bite. And that could be from Piedmont, maybe a Dolcetto, or a Barbera, two wonderful grapes in the northern part of Italy, or right in the area of Tuscany, Chianti or Chianti Classico, made from the Sangiovese grape, another great choice.
So you would have white or red?
I think that there's a lot of flexibility, and I would, you know, base what I wanted to drink on the time of year, the time of day. As we slowly get into the month of May, my mind begins to drift to lighter styles of wine, and wonderful rosés from around the world could be a perfect pairing with this type of dish.
Very nice. The next piece we had was on roasting fish, and these are really very nice recipes. I made the salmon pan roasted last night, and it was just delicious. I made it without the lemon dill butter, which is called for in the recipe. And I wonder how that changes the choice of wine if you use a flavored butter.
A great way to start here is let's start with the protein. And, you know, salmon is a pretty full-bodied fish. I'm fond of saying that salmon is a fish that moves, meaning that it can be more full-bodied than another type of protein like even a chicken or a steak. But when the salmon is not adorned with anything, I think there too, whether you're going for a contrast or similarity, there are many different styles of wines that could work. If you wanted to base the pairing on similarity, the full-bodied quality of the salmon could work well with a full-bodied white wine, like an oaky Chardonnay, with a lot of creaminess and richness. If you wanted to go with the red wine that straddles the world of both red and white wine, a Pinot Noir would be a classic pairing. But when you said you were not going to prepare this dish with a butter or what you would do with different flavored butters, there I would take my cue from what the ingredients could possibly be. So if, let's say, the butter was going to be flavored with dill or cilantro.
Well, this one was flavored with lemon and dill.
Lemon and dill. You know, that sort of green or slightly herbaceous quality that you'll get from the dill, I think transports me to a place like the Loire Valley, where the wonderful wines of Sancerre and Puy-Fumé, both crafted from Sauvignon Blanc grapes, are often marked by having a grassy or slightly herbaceous quality to them, and I think could work really well with the ingredients, specifically dill. So I think the idea, a philosophy to consider, is that sometimes the protein is very important, but sometimes it's an ingredient that can give you inspiration. And I think the idea of dill would lend itself to a very, very fresh style of wine.
Which would also stand up to the salmon?
I think absolutely. What you'd be going for here, in many ways, is not as much of a pairing based on similarity, but rather contrast. The same way that the salmon, which is somewhat of an oily fish, you would often adorn it with a squeeze of lemon to cut through some of that fat, to cut through some of the oils. Serving a Sancerre or a Pouilly Fumé, both marked with really high acidity, would function as that proverbial piece of lemon. So that pairing is really based more on contrast, a full-bodied fish with a very, very light, fresh white wine.
Great. Well, here we have also a whole fish that is roasted over vegetables. The original recipe uses fennel and onions, but she says, go ahead and add tomato and zucchini. Now, wouldn't that change what kind of wine you would serve with that?
Absolutely, but here, too, you've got tomato, which is marked by a lot of acid, and zucchini, which is, I think, just a great, great vegetable that lends just wonderful texture to a dish as well as flavor. But hearing the word zucchini and tomato transports me to Provence. And often my food pairings are not only based on only what might work well and people might enjoy, but can be transported to a different place and a different time. And I think many of the wines coming from the Appalachian or the places of Les Baux de Provence or Bandol can be wonderful. While we know the excellent rosés coming out of these regions, there are also some delicious full-bodied red and white wine, and just having the zucchini and the tomato almost giving like a ragu style, this here too can be, I think, a fish that could stand up to a red wine as well.
Mm. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask was she has a recipe for a whole fish roasted in a salt crust. I suppose it depends on what the fish is, but does the preparation in that case make a difference?
Well, you know, a salt crust is going to yield a fish that is very, very moist and very tender.
Right.
And it will often be well salted, but not salty. And the wonderful thing about adding salt to your food is that it's a great equalizer with wine. It makes wines softer and more accessible. So here too, depending on the style of fish, if it was a light fish, I might go for a light wine. It's an interesting food and wine tip to consider. Pair light foods with light wines, fuller bodied foods with fuller body wines. Mm. So with this dish, there's nothing that's sticking out that's sending me to a certain place or sending me to a certain style, but I would just be driven by what that specific protein is. And whether you cook fish in salt crust or you choose to roast it in parchment paper, it's going to yield a fish style that, again, is generally very fresh and very tender, and it can lead you to many different places. You know, one of the things that so many wine and so many food people are talking about is the idea to acknowledge and work with what's in your backyard. And Virginia is the sixth largest wine-producing state in the Union,
right.
And there are close to 200 wineries now in the Commonwealth, and some of them are absolutely wonderful and are crafting wines that are not only food-friendly, but it's great to drink local.
Well, Michael, this has been tremendously helpful, and I greatly appreciate your time and your thoughts, and thank you.
Bonnie, I'm salivating. Sounds like some really lovely food, and I hope your listeners try some of the pairing.
Thank you. That was Michael Green, wine consultant to Gourmet Magazine. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, May 17th and 18th, Michael will discuss wine trends at the Food and Wine Festival at the new National Harbor on the Potomac River in Prince George's County, Maryland. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes like those for roasted fish and sweet and savory crepes. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.